The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. Lots and lots to get to on today's program. As per usual, we're at the last show of the week as well. Fast-moving week coming into the weekend. Quick update on the PAC numbers. We've got 83 registered for the Birmingham PAC coming up on February the 1st and the 2nd. And then we've got 42, about half the number for Birmingham. We've got 42 that have signed up for Belfast. I believe the final invite goes out next week. So the first pack will be 3 weeks from now, I guess. So something to be praying about as well. We also taped a TV program earlier today on just trying to pull together some of the prophecies we've been talking about over the last week and a half. So much going on right here in the UK, but we focus the program on the Middle East, which has definitely been a headline for many publications these first few days of 2020. What a chaotic start for the Middle East. Here in this new calendar year, you have the U.S. Embassy coming under fire. You have Soleimani and his top lieutenant taken out, killed in a U.S. drone strike just last week, a week ago. And then all that's happened since then, launching the missiles on American targets, or at least getting close to them the other night. And then now, it finally comes out. We learn that this Ukrainian passenger jet, that it was actually taken down by Iran with a surface-to-air missile made by the Russians. The AP had a headline earlier today, an Iranian general dies in U.S. attack and innocents suffer. That would be the innocents on the Ukrainian commercial airliner. So Soleimani dies in the U.S. attack. The U.S. is the one that instigated it. And it set in motion events that led to, that's what they're getting at, or at least what they were getting at before they went in and altered the headline. They can't help themselves. Donald Trump is the cause. Donald Trump is to blame. There were quite a few Canadians on this this airplane. And so the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, he came out yesterday, made a statement. I think 65 or so, 176 died in total. But here is the Prime Minister, and he's getting questions right and left from these reporters who are basically telling him, look, aren't you going to blame President Trump? Here's clip four.
And if the intelligence is accurate, then it seems this is the end result of a sequence of events that was sparked by the drone strike ordered by the U.S. president. So given the information you have, how much responsibility does the United States bear for this tragedy?
The evidence suggests that this is the likely cause, but we need to have a full and complete and credible investigation to establish exactly what happened.
Now, he backed away ever so slightly from that just a little bit later in the press conference. But where is the voice with moral clarity to speak up and say, are you out of your mind? Have you lost your mind? A plane in Iran shot down by Iranian forces after they fired missiles at U.S. positions in Iraq? And somehow, it's Donald Trump's fault because he eliminated the world's number one terrorist. The world's most wanted man As I say, it must have been at least three times. A couple of English-speaking reporters, one French-speaking reporter. Well, now, Donald Trump's to blame here, right? You see the kind of, I said this yesterday, but you see the worldview that these reporters have. You see how they've been educated. The United States is the cause for all world evil, all the problems in the world. And who do you blame? You blame, in this case, the president of the United States. Now, you don't blame him if he's a good progressive like Barack Obama. But certainly in this case, you can pin the blame on Donald Trump. Here's CBC's Katie Simpson and what she said yesterday in her report on a Canadian station. This is her report from Washington, D.C., clip 5.
But I think a significant question that Canadians, particularly the families of these victims, are going to have is, are 63 Canadians dead because of the unintended consequences of a decision made by the U.S. president?
So where does this stop? The unintended consequences. So one decision to take out a terrorist, it's not like this hasn't been done before. We'll go to another example here in just a moment. But where does it stop? What else can you pin the blame on Donald Trump for? It's not just the reporters in Canada. They're picking it up here in the United States as well, or there in the United States. Reporters, like I said, with the AP headline, here's a Democrat working in Congress. A Democrat representative, Jackie Speier, listen to what she said yesterday, clip 6.
I want to start with this plane crash. Have you been briefed on it? Because it certainly sounds like it was a mistake by the Iranians. Do you think they assumed this was some sort of U.S. military plane?
Well, I have been briefed on it, Wolf, in the Intelligence Committee, so I'm not really at liberty to say. But if what is being projected is true, this is yet another example of collateral damage from the actions that have been taken in a provocative way by the President of the United States.
President of the United States, collateral damage. He kills a terrorist in Baghdad, and now he's responsible for a commercial airliner going down in Tehran. Nancy Pelosi, she's doing everything that she can. She said yesterday her job is to save the country. She wants the impeachment proceedings to run in the Senate like she wants them to be run. She's just one little congresswoman from California. She's got a non-binding resolution. There's no real power behind it, but it's intended to prevent the president from acting like he did last week to take out that convoy. You've got to come get congressional authority, she says. Basically, she's telling the president of the United States, before you do anything like that, you've got to call me. You've got to talk to me. You've got to make sure that I approve of it. The president at a rally last night, he mocked her pretty good for that. Like, how can you function as a president, he was saying. How could you get anything done? If your embassy is coming under fire, if your U.S. position, wherever it is coming under attack, you're going to stop and call the men and women of Congress and try to get together and figure this out? Is that what the framers intended? Even Obama's own DHS Secretary Jay Johnson, he came out on Fox yesterday and said, well, of course the president had the authority to take that action. Here's what he had to say, clip 9.
What I have said is that under existing Office of Legal Counsel opinions on the president's constitutional authority to engage the armed forces without a congressional authorization, if you read those opinions, he had ample constitutional authority to take out General Soleimani, if you regard that as an isolated strike. What these OLC opinions say is that the president can take lethal force so long as it's short of war, if it's in the important national interest. And this operation was.
That's Jay Johnson, who used to work for Obama. If it's short of war and lethal action is needed, he has the constitutional authority. Now, if it's a full-on war, a hot war, as they were saying a few days ago, then Congress does need to get involved. It does need to go through Congress. But think about this. This is what's being debated. This man who planned all of these attacks and has been doing so or did so for years and years and years, his hands are drenched with the blood of Americans, hundreds of them. The president explained this last night at one of his rallies. Here he is, clip one.
For years, the sadistic mass murderer, Qassem Soleimani, planned and executed attacks against American targets, killing and wounding thousands of U.S. service members and many, many thousands and even hundreds of thousands of other people. As the leader of Iran's terrorist Quds force, Soleimani spread death, destruction, and mayhem across the Middle East and far beyond. He ordered the violent assault on the American embassy in Baghdad, and you saw this was the anti-Benghazi. We got there very quickly. We got there very quickly. This is the exact opposite. We did it exactly the opposite of Benghazi, where they got there so late. All they saw when they got there days later were burning embers from days before.
Now, just think about, we'll come to more to Benghazi here in just a second, but think about, as far as wanting congressional approval to take action, in 2011, Barack Obama sent all of this NATO coalition. The U.S. led the way on a bombing campaign to pin down Gaddafi, all kinds of military action going on for months. And, we should add, without congressional authority. And then, the next year, the following year, same president that was bombing Libya, turning it into a parking lot the year before, the same president, when the U.S. consulate in Benghazi comes under attack, nothing, no response, no action. Forget about calling Congress to see what we ought to do. Nothing. They blame the whole thing on a video. This year, the U.S. embassy comes under attack in Baghdad. The president quickly responds by sending in the Marines. Soleimani shows up 2 days later to try some kind of an attack, and U.S. forces take him out. Look at the difference. Look at the way these same voices today that would defend any action President Obama would take in Libya or anywhere for that matter. And yet this, it shows you how strong the anti-American forces are right within America. We've made a distinction about the two directions, Antiochus on the one hand, Jeroboam on the other. But be assured that America is still under attack. Here's the president last night talking about Nancy Pelosi's position, defending Soleimani, not the president of the United States, but defending this terrorist. Clip two.
Oh, you know what bothers me? When I see a Nancy Pelosi trying to defend this monster from Iran who's killed so many people, who's so badly, I mean, so many people are walking around now without legs and without arms, because he was the big roadside bomb guy. He was the one who'd send him to Afghanistan, had sent him to Iraq. He was big. That was his favorite thing. He thought it was wonderful. He doesn't think it's wonderful anymore. When Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats want to defend him, I think that's a very bad thing for this country. I think that's a big losing argument politically, too.
Yeah, it's going to also hurt them politically. But that's just a voice of moral clarity, what you heard there. This man loved making those roadside bombs. He loved shipping them over to Iraq. He loved killing American forces. He loves forcefully putting down demonstrations, protests, killing his own people if he has to. 1,500 in Iran, this past year, 300 in Iraq, both nations, almost 2,000 people killed. Killed by Iranian militias in Iraq and killed by the IRGC in Iran. Soleimani heads up the Quds force. If you want to talk about root causes, about how we got to this point, again, for Democrats and member their media allies, Middle East history, as I say, begins 1 week ago today. But if you want to go back to real root causes, well, let's go back to the Iran nuke deal. Let's go back to how that this regime was empowered, where it got all of its funding, at least recently, in recent years. The president, of course, brought that up a couple days ago, which had the Democrats furious. They're very sensitive about that subject, what Iran did with the billions. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, he returned to that subject with some prodding from a journalist here. But here's what he had to say yesterday, clip three.
It's a fantasy to think that the nuclear deal was good for the United States of America in protecting the American people. There were terror campaigns, there were missile systems that were enhanced, improved during the JCPOA. The money that the Iranian regime was permitted to have underwrote the very Shia militias that were the ones that took on and ultimately killed an American. We had a lot of work to do to fix this. This isn't about undoing what Obama did. This is about protecting and defending the American people. And President Trump has been incredibly resolute in that.
That's the Secretary of State being nice there toward the end about, hey, this isn't just about rolling back all that Obama did. But to be sure, as my father has noted, we're looking at two very different directions. And a lot of it is rolling back what was done under the previous administration. Here again, just look at some recent history, like with Libya and the unconstitutional attack. It was a war for months to bring down the Gaddafi regime. The United States led the way. Barack Obama led the way. Hillary Clinton followed in the steps of Obama. Congress didn't have anything to do with it. What led up to that attack, that NATO attack in 2011? You look at Gaddafi, of course, he has a long history with terrorism himself. But in 2003, Gaddafi renounced terrorism and then started to dismantle his nuclear program. And from 2003 through to 2004, 5, 6, 7, these were during the Bush years, but the West, they were reaching out to him and welcoming him back into the international community. In 2006, the United States actually removed Libya from its designation as a terrorist state. So this was a nation that was going in the right direction. During those final years of the Bush administration and then early on, I mean, just looking at it on the surface. And how do you even compare Gaddafi, particularly after 2003, to Soleimani of 2020? They hemmed him in. And then these terrorist militias took him out. Now, the Obama people would say, well, there was a popular uprising there, and we had to support democracy. Did it support democracy in Libya? months and months and months. They bombed away. President Obama said in 2011, he's basically talking to the American people. This is what justified the war against Gaddafi. He said, we knew that if we waited, or if we wanted, or if we waited one more day, Benghazi, this is Obama in 2011, we knew if we waited one more day, Benghazi, a city the size of Charlotte, could suffer a massacre that would have reverberated across the region and stained the conscience of the world. It wasn't, for one, it wasn't a popular uprising. This was a terrorist uprising. These were groups linked to Al-Qaeda and Iran that knew they had an opportunity to get rid of the authoritarian so that they could run the place. But the Obama people said, no, 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 this is a popular uprising, so we've got to support the people. And they trapped Gaddafi in Sirte, his home city. They surrounded him. They set up a no-fly zone. And the terrorists converged upon his palace. Isn't it amazing that Barack Obama said he acted? He acted in 2011 so that a massacre in Benghazi, of all places, didn't happen. And then in 2012, when these terrorist groups, Gaddafi's long gone, when these terrorist groups overrun the Benghazi consulate, the U.S. consulate, the same Obama team, they say, stand down. Don't you do anything. Don't you take any action. And four Americans were murdered, including America's own ambassador, Chris Stevens. Well, you back up a year from that, as I say, they trapped Gaddafi in his home city. And these terrorists pulled him out of his palace, sodomized him, drug him through the streets. There's footage of this on YouTube. These were the new leaders of Libya. Libya had been liberated. Who can forget what Hillary Clinton said with a reporter soon after? Or I don't remember if it was right after, but she yucked it up with a reporter. She said, we came, we saw, he died. Gaddafi died. And then she had a good laugh. This is Obama in 2011 talking about the war against Libya. Clip 10.
Our brave pilots have flown in Libya's skies. Our sailors have provided support off Libya's shores. And our leadership at NATO has helped guide our coalition.
And we should add, no congressional authority. He didn't get any of that approved in Congress. They took out Gaddafi. They handed it over to terrorist groups. It led to, let's talk about motives. Let's talk about what caused the attack on Benghazi. We got to do that. Well, aren't they doing that today? They are, except that it's exactly upside down from the way it should be. It's the opposite of what happened in 2011 and 12. They finished up in 2011. Gaddafi had been brutally murdered. And Obama said that was the end of a long and painful chapter in Libya. Everything was about to turn into a Garden of Eden utopia. He talked about the new and democratic Libya. He said Libya can now determine its own destiny. In 2011, Nancy Pelosi, she's the same one that brought up the resolution yesterday, saying, you can't do what you did, President Trump. You've got to call me. You've got to call Chuck Schumer. You've got to call Adam Schiff. You've got to get congressional authority to take any kind of action like that. She was asked this in 2011. Clip 8.
Madam Leader, you're saying that the president did not need authorization initially and still does not need any authorization from Congress on Libya?
Yes.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. Of course he doesn't need congressional authority. He's President Obama. If Obama decides to do it, it has to be right. Brad McDonald had an article at the Trumpet. This was in February of 2011. You can see it there on your screen. The stunning truth behind Libya's democratic revolution. He's got democratic in quotes. That's what we were told. That's what we were told going in. Look, Benghazi, Gaddafi's forces they're pushing up to Benghazi to put down this rebellion. It's not really a rebellion. It's just a popular uprising. There's about to be a massacre. We've got to take action. We've got to bomb Libya. We've got to remove Gaddafi. We've got to take him out. We came, we saw, he died. Mr. McDonald wrote, and this is 7 months before the attack on the Benghazi consulate. He says, despite what we've been told, it appears the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi wasn't an organic grassroots uprising that will end with a democratically elected, stable, peaceful government taking root in Tripoli. Rather, evidence shows the violent rebellion was years in planning and carried out with craft and cunning. And while Gaddafi was defeated by a motley crew of obscure local militias, the broader rebellion was shaped and exploited by the masterminds of global Islamic terrorism. Yes, indeed. He said later in the article, Al-Qaeda's presence in Libya's revolution strongly indicates Iran's presence too. Oh yeah, Soleimani even had his fingerprints on the Benghazi attack. That's the truth. And then he attacks the Baghdad embassy as well. Just this year. And finally, you have a U.S. president that took action, took him out. He's not going to be making roadside bombs anymore, said President Trump. Well, 7 months after that article, Brad McDonald's article at the Trumpet, the U.S. consulate in Benghazi came under attack. And 4 Americans died, and the Obama administration did nothing. Congress didn't do anything. We didn't even make any arrests following the attack. We had articles in the Trumpet, I think it was a year after the Benghazi attack. Still searching, can't really find anyone. We can't really find anyone. We can't even put someone in jail for a little bit. 4 Americans murdered and nothing. No action. In that article, Mr. McDonald quoted from author John Rosenthal. He said this, the uprising in Libya was the realization not of democratic aspirations, but of the long-standing ambitions of Islamic extremists. It was an Islamist spring that paved the way for today's Islamist winter. That's just a little bit of recent history. These are events that have all happened in the last 10 years. And look at the way they're covered or not covered. Look at the way they're forgotten. I played that clip for you yesterday. A U.S. congressman saying that, well, you didn't see any of this in the Obama years. No protests. No U.S. Servicemen killed, no contractors, no American contractors, no kidnappings, nothing like that during Obama. That's all happened since Donald Trump came into office. As I said earlier, the attack against the United States, it's not over with this administration. It's intensifying. How else do you explain all of this it's upside down through and through. How do you explain it? Except that you know and you understand that there is a real spirit world. There certainly is. Revelation 12 and verse 7, it says, "And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought and his angels and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven." They were kicked out of heaven. This is an end time prophecy. A war in heaven between angels, these great angelic beings, and then Satan the devil and his demons. And notice what this great spiritual war resulted in. Verse 9, it says, "And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him." As we've pointed out so many times before, he was cast out into this earth, and now he's confined to this earth. He's the reason. The demons confined to this earth, they are the reason that we see troubles intensifying, that we see a world full of problems that are getting worse and worse and worse. I don't think we've ever seen anything quite like these people that rush now. They rush to the defense of a hardened terrorist who's killed so many Americans, so many Muslims, so many Christians. There is a real spirit world. We certainly see proof of that every day. And you know what else we see every day? We see, as I covered on the program earlier today, we're seeing fulfilled prophecies being fulfilled right before our eyes. You just strip away for a moment the administrations at play in some of this history I just covered the last 10 years. You see everything lining up perfectly, even with Libya. Knowing what we know about Daniel 11, the king of the north coming against the king of the south, this pushy king of the south just keeps pushing and pushing and pushing. It maybe doesn't have a huge amount of power, but it certainly does push. It can calculate. It can push ahead and then maybe pull back before it's going to get pounded. But at some point, they're going to push too much. And it's not going to be the United States that comes against it. It's the King of the North. It's the seventh and final resurrection of the Holy Roman Empire. This King of the South, my father identified it in 1993, the Islamic State of Iran. It says in this same prophecy, the King of the North is going to enter into the glorious land. That would be the Middle East. That would be in and around Jerusalem. It says in verse 42, "He shall stretch forth his hand also upon the countries, and the land of Egypt shall not escape." And then in the next verse, verse 43, it mentions the Ethiopians and the Libyans, Libya and Egypt both. All that turmoil in 2011, toppling the Mubarak regime. And then Obama clearing out Gaddafi and letting the terrorists fill the vacuum. You see the nations as they're being prepared to line up with the King of the South. Iran, Libya, Egypt, Ethiopia, and yes, Iraq. That's a prophecy we've been talking about for decades. 1994, who can forget? The headline is Iraq about to fall to Iran? That was in 94. And then you fast forward to 2003. This massive invasion, U.S. invasion of Iraq. All of these forces, U.S. forces, tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands involved. And my father wrote in 2003, "It may seem shocking given the U.S. presence in the region right now, but prophecy indicates that in pursuit of its goal, Iran will probably take over Iraq." And that's what we've been talking about for the past week and a half. That's what we're seeing. The Iraqis know it. That's why they've been protesting since early October. That's why 300 of them were killed, were put down by these Iranian militias. Because the Iraqis, they know they've lost their country. They know Iran is in charge. And so did the Trump administration. You see Soleimani, as I've said, bouncing around from Damascus to Tehran, and then he's landing in Baghdad. Just 36 hours or so after the U.S. embassy, just across the street practically from the Baghdad airport, it came under fire from these Iranian militias that painted on the gate, the guard gate at the U.S. embassy. Soleimani's our leader. You get out of here. You get out. We obey Soleimani. And wouldn't you know it, Soleimani shows up just a day and a half later. And judging by the reporting, judging by what you're hearing Democrats say, he should have been greeted at the airport with a nice, loving handshake. This is, after all, a hero. This is a great general. He should be welcomed to the region. He should be admired. Upside down, isn't it? How do you explain it? There is an explanation. There certainly is. All of this. You talk about the coalition that's revealed in Daniel 11, in Psalm 83. You've got the coalition that forms in opposition to Iran. And that would be nations like Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Syria, Lebanon. Yes, those two, they're going to peel away from Iran. That's prophesied. And we're in the early stages of that. Brent Noctegal brought this out in his, I think it was the January magazine. You've had all kinds of protests going on in Lebanon as well. I think a fourth of the country turned out. That's incredible. They're so unhappy with Hezbollah's dominance. They're so unhappy with Iranian influence that they're taking to the streets a fourth of the country. So you have it there in Lebanon, you have it in Iraq, you have it in Iran as well. And in Iraq and Iran, they were put down forcefully. Not so in Lebanon, because Iran's position in Lebanon is not quite as strong. The real prize here for Iran is its next-door neighbor, the neighbor it shares 1,000 miles of border with, and that would be Iraq. The one it fought all through the 1980s to try to overthrow. And then with Saddam Hussein firmly entrenched in power in the 1990s, it looked like it would just be a permanent standoff. Maybe the two would counterbalance each other. They were both powerful. But here's the little Trumpet magazine saying Iraq is about to fall to Iran. Where did you read about that in the 1990s? Where did you read about that in 2003? Except at The Trumpet, thetrumpet.com. And now we see the United States saying, look, we want to get European forces in there. We want for European forces to keep the peace. We want to get out. We want to vacate the region. We're tired of fighting. America is backing out. That's what we wrote about last year. And as I read the other day, every important biblical prophecy that takes place in the Middle East occurs in a power vacuum created by America's exit. In fact, Bible prophecy indicates that the U.S. will have vacated so entirely from the Middle East that it will not impact it at all. Think about what you've read at thetrumpet.com for the past decades, two going on 3 decades, America is going to vacate the Middle East. We're very close to that. We're down to 5,000-6,000 troops. And they can't even take out the world's most wanted terrorist without their own people back home on the Democratic side and in the media absolutely outraged that they would protect the U.S. embassy like that. America's about to vacate the Middle East. We've said it. We've said it for decades. Iraq will fall to Iran. We've said it since 1993. Egypt and Libya, they're going to swing over to the anti-Iranian camp. And certainly with the instability in those nations, particularly in Libya, there's some work to be done to complete that. But it's in the works, and it's the same with Syria and Lebanon. They're going to peel away in the other direction. Psalm 83, Asher, the Assyrians, Germany today, building this coalition, building this Psalm 83 alliance, and then coming against that king of the south, like a whirlwind. You know, you should read the first part of that psalm, Psalm 83, because it's not even just about taking out the king of the south. Ultimately, the ultimate aim is to blot out the name of Israel. That clash in Daniel 11:40, that's just the trigger of a much wider scale conflict, a worldwide war. And it's coming after our nations as well. When we come back, we'll take you through this inspiring email we got earlier this week. One of our listeners down in Australia, whose house was very nearly destroyed by these ongoing bushfires, he has quite the story to tell. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The developed nations have made awesome progress. They have produced a highly mechanized world, providing every luxury, modern convenience, and means of pleasure. Yet they are cursed with crime, violence, injustice, sickness and disease, broken homes and families. At the same time, more than one half the world is living in illiteracy, abject poverty, filth and squalor. Violence and destruction are rapidly multiplying. Many ask, why, if God exists, does he allow so much violence and human suffering? To understand the reason behind this astonishing paradox, request a complimentary copy of Mystery of the Ages. We were born into this 20th century world as it is. We take it for granted, but we can't explain it. It's like viewing a movie at a point already near the end. We see what is occurring at that point, but not having seen it from the beginning and not knowing how events developed to the point of viewing, we simply cannot understand what we are seeing. Mystery of the Ages transports you back to the beginning of the movie, to the foundation of this present evil world. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
I'm just going to wait with the mic there.
Touching scene there from the Sydney airport yesterday as 155 American firefighters show up to help fight against these these out-of-control bushfires. Here's the Trump administration. I wonder if those people realize the Trump administration is behind this. Surely something bad is going to happen. They're quite happy to receive help from America, from Canada. These fires, these out-of-control fires, 18 million acres have burned. You put, as I read earlier, you put Belgium together with Denmark. That's the size of this scorched earth. At least 27 people have died. This is the first time, by the way, that America has sent help. Australia's done it for American fires before, and the U.S. did it back in 2010. I mentioned we had a listener in the southeast of Australia who wrote a long email following the program we did on Monday. And he says here, and it's important to know, this wasn't something that was just last weekend or a couple weeks ago. This has been going on for months. It says, around 6 weeks ago, a fire started burning about 30 kilometers from our home in a remote bushland area. Fires like that are not uncommon over the summer in Australia, but they rarely come close to more populated areas. See, and one reason they're getting so close to populated areas, as I mentioned on Monday, is because of arson. People who are burning down communities. They want to burn down communities. It says, by the 2nd of December, this fire started moving closer to the edges of populated areas near us. One area was where my brother lives, on a farm property. Upon ringing to check his safety, I found him collapsing from smoke inhalation and had to rush through two fire roadblocks to get him into hospital. The following day, after he had recovered, I took him back to his home, and we did a final tidy-up, fed his animals, got some supplies from his home, and were ready to evacuate when the fire brigade turned up on trail bikes. They informed us that the fire was going to hit in 10 minutes and to get ready. They left and said no help could get to us and that we were on our own. It says, for the next 6 hours, we fought the fire. We fought the fire off and protected my brother's house with an old firefighting pump that was only intermittently squirting out water. It says, fire reached onto the decks of the house, but we were able to extinguish them before too much damage was done. It says the fire, however, was not and still is not done. A week later, the fire had moved to within 5 kilometers of my home. So now it's coming upon this listener's home. He saved his brothers, or helped to. And then now it's coming down hard on his property. It says, on heightened alert, we did regular trips to close by vantage points to see where the fire had gotten to, and watched intently the local fire and weather reports. It said most nights were set on an hourly watch between my wife and me to ensure the fire had not advanced to our property. Several times with hot, windy conditions, the fire moved closer until it reached 400 meters from our home. It says, with a weather change and cooler conditions, that section of the fire went out. Finally, on the 31st of December, we felt the immediate risk had passed. Well, as it turns out, he points out how that quite a few of the fire trucks took off for other regions, thinking that in his region, it had all died out. It says, though, at 10 a.m. that morning, listening to the local emergency radio station, reports started coming in of nearby road closures due to a fire flare-up. I looked out the window and saw the fire coming our way and in a hurry. I phoned my wife to get home quickly. By the time she was within 500 meters from our home, fire was leaping on both sides of the road. Our neighbors were fleeing in their cars along the road through the flames to safety, but my wife forged her way at speed through the flames to get back to be by my side. It says, by the time she hopped out of the car, I had all of our firefighting equipment hooked up and flames were visible from the house. I quickly gathered the family for a final check that we were ready. Pump on, check. Boots, hats, gloves, masks, goggles, check. It says, with that in place, the most important preparation was next. Over the last week, I had studied a passage sent through from a local church member who was trying to encourage us. It's Isaiah 43 and verse 2, which says, "When you walk through the fire, you shall not be burned, neither shall the flame kindle upon you." He writes, God had promised his protection. He never said you wouldn't walk through fire, but that he would not let the flame kindle on you. Mr. Armstrong said if God had promised it, we need to boldly go and claim the promise from him. So we went to our Creator and took that verse to him. We knew we were going to walk through fire. We claimed the promise, directly asking not to be burnt physically and for the protection of our home. He says, finishing our prayer, we headed out the door. Within minutes, a wall of flames, 50 meters high, approached us from the north and quickly enveloped every section of our 4 acres of land. Each of us ran, putting out fires as they came close, and for 6 hours, literally walked through fire. The fire intensity in the area was so great, we heard thunder coming from it. This was one of those really strange phenomenons where the fire itself produced a storm cloud and thunder to go with it. He says, we hooked our firefighting pump into our swimming pool and during the day drained about 30,000 liters of water from it, blasting any flame in sight. It says, on an occasional reprieve, I ran to our closest neighbor who had evacuated and defended her home, and then he says that he would come back to his house. It says, on the trip, let me just skip a little bit further. It says, although they had the same equipment as I did, a single ember had worked its way up into the section of their roof. This is another neighbor that was trying to defend their property, and their house went up in flames. He says it was destroyed within about 15 minutes. But his house was spared. His property was spared. We claimed God's promise, he writes, and he provided within 500 meters from our home. Half of the houses have burnt to the ground. Those that didn't lose their homes all lost sheds and equipment. A close-by residential subdivision that was hit with the same fire front that we were hit with lost over 100 homes and several lives even. After the flames died down, we assessed our home, our sheds, and other assets and realized that we had lost nothing. God kept his promise. Everyone that has seen our house can't believe our house is standing. Everyone that's seen it, they just can't believe it. Well, the story doesn't end there. He then talks about last weekend. That's when the temperature got up to nearly 50 degrees Celsius. He says, with the heat of the day, everything felt like it was on fire. I went to work, wetting down our house for potentially another round of firefighting. I received a message of a cold front heading along the coastline 15 minutes from our home. So we drove to a vantage point to watch it arrive. The cold front, however, brought winds over 80 kilometers an hour and whipped up some fires beyond a nearby township. It says, from where we stood, plumes of smoke billowed over a kilometer into the sky and looked like a bomb had gone off. It says that smoke was the result of what, again, was this fire devastating more homes in its destructive path in the next town over. It says the smoke and ash that it blew toward us was so thick that we could not see with our lights of the car on full beam. Upon reaching home, I rushed my wife and children into the house, and being pelted by flying leaves, smoke, and branches, proceeded to wet down our house as we expected the worst again. Fortunately, now nothing was left to burn, and the storm's harshness slowed over the next half an hour. So much of the area around his home had been scorched already that the fire finally gave out. He says finally in his email that one of the most disgusting things in this whole process was the looting. Looting, people that would come into partially burned homes to steal things, or they'd show up at the front door and say, yeah, we're the authorities, you've got to evacuate. And then they'd proceed to help themselves to that individual's belongings. There were also, obviously, acts of kindness and generosity as well. But he just concludes here, after seeing all this, he says, in our general area, however, the best of the human spirit is also, it also has been on display. But knowing the intensity of the tribulation to come, society will fall apart very quickly. He talked about people, you know, hurrying into stores and just grabbing things off the shelves, taking it out of the hands of someone else. And he just thought, how is it going to be when we get to the beginning stages of the Great Tribulation? Well, without God, of course, there would be no hope. But with God, we can walk right through fire. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, send comments to td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. Thank you for joining us all week, and we'll see you next week.